are going to talk about the ethical, the political, and the legal implications of a 20-week abortion ban in Wisconsin. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Governor Scott Walker this week, in an open letter that was posted on the website of the Weekly Standard, said that he expected the state legislature to propose legislation that would ban abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy in Wisconsin. And he wrote, "I will sign that bill when it gets to my desk and support similar legislation on the federal level." We will talk about this proposed ban on abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy in Wisconsin, and we will welcome your reactions and your questions for our guest at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let me welcome our guest. Very happy to have back with us Alta Charo, who is Professor of Law and Bioethics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
All right, well, let's talk a little bit about Governor Walker making these headlines this week. He has always been against abortion. We've known that, but this is the first we've heard of this coming up. What do you make of this?
Well, first, I would preface it by saying that I've seen so many conflicting reports on what the governor has actually said about his precise position on abortion that I'm personally not willing to claim to understand it. But as far as this particular bill goes, this is a kind of proposal that we have seen in other parts of the United States. There are about 12 other, maybe 13 states that have passed similar kinds of bans on abortion following 20 weeks of pregnancy. They all pose one very fundamental problem, and that is that they are unconstitutional under the current law as dictated by the decision Roe versus Wade and the subsequent abortion decision.
Why are they unconstitutional?
Because Roe versus Wade's kind of central holding was that the civil rights of a woman or anybody who's been born are superior to any rights the state might confer on a pre-viable fetus. After viability, things can change. But before viability, the court said we have to take the civil rights of people who've already been born more seriously, and those rights are superior. Now, viability is a moment in pregnancy. It's a little hazy when exactly it is, but it is most certainly not at 20 weeks. There's no question and no disagreement in the medical community that is simply too early, and if you were to, in fact, take that fetus out of a person's body, that fetus would die. You would not have a live-born child.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but the Roe versus Wade does allow states to have bans on abortion beyond 22 to 24 weeks, is that right?
Well, it says, in Roe versus Wade, they roughly calculated viability as the beginning of the third trimester. Now, that's already 40 years old, and technology has changed, and so there is a kind of window of viability. It depends on kind of what you mean by viability. If you have a birth and a child that survives for a minute or 10 minutes or 15 minutes and dies, is that considered viable or not? These are questions of judgment and definition. But Roe versus Wade said that after the moment of viability, however defined, the states are free to limit abortion, provided that even then, a pregnant woman's own right to protect her health and to protect her life are still superior to any rights that the state might be conferring on the as-yet undelivered child. And so we have two problems here. One is 20 weeks is still pre-viable, and indeed, depending on how the bill is written, it may be dating the pregnancy in a way that is not consistent with medical practice, and it would be effectively an 18-week ban, not a 20-week ban. So it's definitely pre-viable. And second, many of these statutes around the rest of the country, and I don't know what the bill in Wisconsin would say, many of these statutes fail to actually provide the necessary exceptions to the ban when a woman's life or health are in danger.
The governor noted, or I guess supporters of such a ban have noted, that a fetus feels pain at 20 weeks. Do we know if that's true?
Well, there's one doctor in the United States who's been testifying to that effect now for over a decade, but every medical society has actually contradicted him. The most reliable source, I think, would be the doctors who know best, which is the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists. This is their business. And they have actually put out a statement saying that this is not true because there may be ability for the body to apparently respond to a stimulus. Like if you were to poke something, you might see a body recoil. You might even see certain hormone levels change. But that's not the same thing as pain. Pain requires some kind of perception and understanding of the experience. And the parts of the brain that do that simply haven't developed yet. So the American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists says, no, this is not true. But even more so, even if it were true, even if it were, the answer is not to then ban the abortion. The answer would be, in theory, to use anesthesia so that there'd be no pain, which was a proposal about a decade ago in other states. So it kind of is problematic on two levels in terms of both the correctness of the assertion and also the solution that's proposed.
And can you tell us how this proposed ban on abortions after 20 weeks is different than what is currently allowed in Wisconsin right now?
Well, like every other state, Wisconsin is subject to Supreme Court jurisprudence, and so Wisconsin has a variety of rules that restrict access to abortion, make it much harder to get an abortion, but it is still legal to get an abortion in Wisconsin up through the first two trimesters, or at least up through viability. After that, there is a general prohibition, except for situations where a woman's life or her health are at risk. Wisconsin does have some pre-Roe versus Wade criminal legislation that dates back to the 1960s that would make abortion completely illegal, but that statute is ineffective because it was ruled unconstitutional by Roe versus Wade. If Roe versus Wade were overturned, there is a question about whether that older statute would immediately come into effect or whether the legislature would have to enact new laws to recriminalize abortion.
Planned Parenthood says that nearly 99% of abortions occur before 21 weeks. Any senses to whether that is the case? And why would a woman need to have an abortion after that?
Well, first of all, it is true. The vast, vast, vast majority of abortions take place not only before 21 weeks, but actually before 12. So this is where I think the 20-week ban is both doing too little and too much. If the point of it is to actually stop abortions from happening, it's not going to work because so very few take place at this late stage. And if the point is to somehow make abortion unavailable to those people you most disapprove of, it also fails because the very few people who need these late abortions tend to fall into a certain set of categories, and this has been documented by studies. First, it tends to be people who've discovered very late in a pregnancy that they've got some profound problem. They're carrying a child that is absolutely going to be born into the worst possible circumstances with, you know, constant seizures, no brain, you know, no functional cognitive activity, tremendous pain, and a likely very short lifespan. Because of some profound problem in development. Or it's somebody who has developed a terrible medical condition herself, and it is going to be incredibly hard for her to get through a pregnancy without risking her health or risking her fertility if she wants to have children in the future. So that's one group of people who actually are trying to have children, and they've run into a horrible problem very late in the game and are making an agonizing decision. Another group tends to be people who have delayed because they are scared to tell people that they're pregnant, and they're scared to face the fact that they're pregnant and make some decisions. And this is often teenagers who've been raped or have been the subject of incest. And again, you know, this is not a group of people who are unsympathetic. And it's the last group of people you would want to punish by making it even more difficult. I mean, think about the obstacles already in terms of waiting periods, the number of clinics that have been closed because they're unable to meet requirements that actually are not medically necessary to provide safe abortions, but are being enacted solely to make abortion more difficult to access. The longstanding lack of any kind of public financing. So it's already hard to get one. So imagine that you are 14 years old, you've been the victim of incest, you're terrified to tell anybody, and you finally get to the point where you cannot hide the pregnancy much any longer. You finally are going to do something about it. You run into difficulties getting to a place, and by now it's 20 weeks. Is this the person you really want to punish? I don't think so. So the 20-week ban, I don't think it actually saves many fetuses from being terminated. I don't think it actually punishes women, if that's what you're trying to do, because it doesn't punish the ones who are it punishes the ones that are the most sympathetic and the least deserving of any kind of punishment.
Governor Walker did get a lot of flack, criticism from some influential conservatives when on a weekend, I think it was Fox News Sunday, made a statement about Roe versus Wade, saying it's the law of the land and there's not a whole lot he could do to change the law of the land. And then this came up. And now there is a proposed ban on abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy in Wisconsin, days after that controversy. I'm wondering, I know, Alta Sharo, you're a professor of law and bioethics, not necessarily of political science, but you are politically astute. What do you think is going on here?
Well, I thank you for the comment. I'm not sure I am, but I don't think it takes somebody who's politically astute to appreciate this. The 20-week bans are among a handful of legislative moves in the last few years across the United States to basically try to tee up the kind of Armageddon of abortion jurisprudence, and that is a direct challenge to Roe versus Wade. That's what all these statutes do. They are basically kind of an in-your-face moment with the Supreme Court saying, we dare you to say that these are unconstitutional, and they look at the court and they look at the makeup of the court and they say, you know, maybe these people are now ready to back away from Roe and change their holding and say it's a matter for individual states, or say that the civil rights of a pregnant woman are somehow going to be inferior to those of an unborn, pre-viable child. And in fact, pregnant women simply, once they're pregnant, must be basically drafted into service to make sure that a baby is born. I mean, they're trying to come up with some way to force the issue. And it's a bit of a game of chicken, because if they lose and Roe versus Wade is once again reaffirmed, it's going to set them back a while. Politically speaking, it's a wonderful kind of opportunity to position yourself as a strong opponent, not only of abortion, but of abortion rights. And at the same time, to not really risk having abortions made illegal, which might actually annoy enough people that they don't want to vote for you. So you kind of get your cake and eat it, too.
We are talking with Alta Charo, who is a professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison. We are talking about the legal, the ethical, the political implications of a 20-week abortion ban in Wisconsin, which is something Governor Walker has said he would sign a bill that would ban abortions after 20 weeks in Wisconsin, and that he expects the legislature to send him one this session. So what do you make of all this? And do you support or oppose banning abortion at 20 weeks in Wisconsin? 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. We are talking about Governor Walker's call for and his letter that he issued this week, saying that he would sign a bill banning abortion in Wisconsin after 20 weeks of pregnancy. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Let's go to the phones. Elizabeth in Appleton is with us. Hello, Elizabeth.
Good morning. I'm glad you've got this subject on the air because while I'm not at all a supporter of Governor Walker, in fact, I signed the recall petition, I am glad that he has proposed something about abortion because I have a son with a severe disability. And in my research, I learned that there was a study, actually it's quite dated, so it's not even just very recent, that showed at that time, I think out of Boston, that 90% of babies diagnosed in utero with Down syndrome were aborted. 90%. And to me, that indicates an attitude that after 20 weeks, if someone discovers that the baby isn't perfect or it somehow doesn't meet some standard of perfection, like my son, that they don't think that that baby deserves a chance at life. And so I think that an abortion after 20 weeks, banning abortion after 20 weeks is not unreasonable.
Professor Charles?
Well, one of the really delicate problems we face here is that there are many things that most of us or just some of us would find to be regrettable, unethical, immoral. And yet the separate question is whether or not the government should enforce that particular view. And that's a theme that runs through all of abortion rights. So what we have in situations where you've got children who are predicted to be born with severe disabilities, and by the way, Down syndrome is not a severe disability in many cases, but nonetheless, children that are predicted to be born with that, you have parents who are facing a very, very difficult situation. And here's the real question. Do you want the government to have a bunch of people who sit down and write out a list of conditions and say, parents are not entitled to abort for this condition, but they are entitled to abort for that condition? That's a kind of problematic scenario, and it's one of the reasons why we often will simply go back to the idea that the people who know best are going to be the individual parent. That said, I will tell you that the caller is absolutely right, that the frequency of abortion for Down syndrome has leaped over the last 50 years, and that far fewer children, dramatically fewer children, are born with that condition now, even though many of those people have very happy lives. But, ironically, 20 weeks, that's not when you're going to find it out. You would find out about Down syndrome much, much earlier. You could find out about it as early as the first trimester of pregnancy, because all you're looking for is a triple chromosome, and that's the easiest thing to see. When I was 15 years old, I was working in a laboratory where we actually had people that were doing this kind of work with amniocentesis. And even that, which was much later, was something that was done around 16 weeks. So I don't think the 20-week ban will get at that particular condition, or indeed at many, many other conditions that present much earlier because they're detectable earlier.
Elizabeth, thank you for the call. Jeff in Madison is with us now. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, thanks for the opportunity to talk. When a man should not be talking about what women have to go through, it should be their choice, even given that the man, one man, the father of the child, is not going to carry the child. It should be the mother's choice. She bears the child.
Yeah. What about that, Professor Charles?
Well, I think it's, of course, true that men don't have the same experience of carrying the pregnancy or going through the birth. And at least still today, the pattern of behavior is that women tend to take a larger share of responsibility for child care, regardless of who is working outside the home in the family. I'm not willing to say that men should have no role in this. They certainly have an emotional stake in this, and it is part of their identity to be a father or not to be a father. But I am very sympathetic with the general notion that there is a special role for women as individuals
in making these decisions that is different than the role of men or of governments or of politicians. You know, Arizona passed one of these 20-week bans to make abortion illegal, even in case of extreme health risk to the mother or fatal fetal anomalies. To this concern, when there was a court challenge, the Solicitor General of Arizona replied, quote, "With due respect, that's the woman's problem," unquote. That's a very callous response that I think denies the reality of the emotions around this kind of situation and the experience that people have.
I'm Julie Cardine talking with Alta Charo, who is a professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison. We're talking about the ethical, the political, the legal implications of a 20-week abortion ban in Wisconsin. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the politics, Professor Charo. In that Fox News interview on Sunday that conservatives got upset over, Chris Wallace played an ad from Governor Walker's 2014 reelection campaign against Democratic candidate Mary Burke. In the ad, Walker says legislation that he signed leaves the final decision about terminating a pregnancy to a woman and her doctor. And he then also explained to Chris Wallace that he is against abortion, but said that the U.S. Supreme Court, with Roe versus Wade, declared abortions are legal. Do you see him changing positions here? Do you see him flip-flopping? Do you see him pandering? What do you see here?
Again, you know, I don't want to put words in the governor's mouth. I'm not qualified to do that, but this is a topic where there are lots of nuances, and it is often very difficult to really force people to be specific about their actual beliefs. So a key question is, are you opposed to abortion or abortion rights? Are you opposed to having abortions? Do you think they're immoral? It's different from whether you think the government should make them illegal and throw somebody in jail for having one or for performing one. That's a very big distinction. And to say I'm against abortion could be understood either way, depending upon the listener and the context. The second thing is, even if you are, well, the Supreme Court says that it's legal, my action, still leave it up to the woman and her doctor, only goes halfway, because first, it doesn't let us know whether or not you'd like to challenge that court decision. And second, it doesn't let us know whether you are planning to put as many obstacles as possible in the way of somebody who wants to exercise that constitutionally protected choice. And that's where we get into all of the rules about false information that must be recited to a woman before she can give so-called informed consent, or forcing her to undergo medical procedures that are not necessary, like the transvaginal ultrasound that were the subject of such debate, or requirements for how the clinic building is constructed that are not necessary to make the procedure safe, but do make it almost impossible for the clinics to actually stay open because they can't renovate the buildings fast enough. Or requiring admitting privileges for the physicians at nearby hospitals, even though in case of an emergency, you don't need admitting privileges to get your patient to a hospital. So those are the kinds of things that can play to the opponents of abortion rights, because it indicates that you are trying to make it almost impossible to get one, and yet technically allows you to say to people who support rights, hey, I'm still not making it illegal. And so you can present yourself to all sides of the political spectrum as somehow being their ally.
To Brian in Clear Lake. Hello, Brian.
Yes, hello. I'm just bringing a little anecdotal piece to the picture here. I don't know statistics or heavy facts on the issue, but being a pastor for some 20 years now at four different churches, including an inner city church in northeast Minneapolis, counseling lots of women over the years and couples and so forth, one picture that has become clear to me is many women who've had abortions suffer from guilt and extreme anxiety over their decision to have the abortion for many years to come. And I think anybody who wants to advocate for women has to consider the challenge it is to go through something like that. And I bring that up only because, as well, I had to pull over off the side of the road as I was driving today. we had a ministerial meeting. Once a month we meet, and this topic did come up. I know it's not just something that I've had to face, but the psychic issue involved, I guess, is what I'm trying to remind the listeners today about is many women who've had abortions are extremely devastated by the experience, and I think before we get too far afield, we have to remember that issue as well. Thank you.
All right. Professor Charles?
Yeah, this has been the subject of a lot of interest and a lot of study, and I do not in any way dispute the anecdotes that the pastor is offering. He's absolutely right. There are many women who come out from this experience having regretted it, either right away or later on. And indeed, it is an experience that is a life-determining experience, just like the decision to have a baby, which is even more momentous because then you are going to live very actively with the consequences for decades. The decision to not have a baby is also a life-determining decision. But I would say this. The pastor is not seeing a complete range of the women who've had abortions. He's seeing the ones who already are distressed. That's why they're coming to talk to him. So he's not seeing a really representative group. And there have been many, many efforts to really get a handle on the kind of range of experiences that women have. Indeed, there was a paper that was written that suggested that they suffer from elevated rates of depression and suicidal thinking. But it turned out the paper was so flawed, so fraudulent, that it actually had to be withdrawn by the journal. And that the studies are consistently showing that the level of distress and depression and whatever that women have after abortion reflects their lives before they got pregnant more than the fact that they had the abortion. That women who were in difficult situations, who were living with an abusing partner, who were living in extreme poverty, who had so many children they already couldn't afford to support them and were struggling, that these women, who then sometimes were the ones who would go and get an abortion, would emerge from that experience depressed and sometimes on the point of suicide. And it wasn't necessarily the abortion that was the key variable here. It was the lives that they had already been living. So I think this is a really important topic. It is one that requires a careful study to really know what most women are experiencing as opposed to the few that we're seeing in certain situations. And again, just to go back to an earlier theme, it also continually raises the question of what is the role of the government and what is the role of law in steering people away from decisions they might regret or stopping them from making decisions that they might regret. We come across this kind of phenomenon very often, and in the U.S., more often than not, we don't see that as the role of government, but that is also a central part of this debate.
Thank you, Pastor Brian. Barbara in Madison is with us now. Hello, Barbara.
Hello. Thank you for having me. I'm a retired nurse anesthetist. I rarely gave anesthesia for abortions, but when I did, it was generally in the hospital after 20 weeks. It was a case of a young girl who found out she had a intra-abdominal malignancy. If she didn't get treatment, she would most surely die. She needed surgery, radiation, and chemo. She either had to have the abortion or she was going to die. And probably the child died also. The other case I recall very clearly was a couple who desperately wanted a child, found out it shortly after 5 months that the child had undeveloped lungs, would not survive more than an hour or two after birth, and believe me, dying from suffocation is not fun. They chose to abort. Both cases were tragic. I think anybody who would judge either parent has no compassion. I don't think we can judge another person's personal situation. This is an individual decision. They're going to have to deal with the consequences, whether it's raising a severely handicapped child or whether it's having an abortion. We have no right to interfere with somebody's lifelong decisions.
Thank you for sharing your experiences, Barbara. Professor Charles, a reaction?
Well, I thank you for the anecdotes because they are good examples of the kinds of reasons why women and girls find themselves in this situation at such a late stage of pregnancy. I completely agree with the caller that these things are tragic. But it also points up one of the real problems with these laws as they've been written around the United States. You know, we only have about four that have any kind of exception for these kinds of extreme fetal anomalies, including ones where the child is going to die within hours or days. And those exceptions are written so ambiguously that most physicians would be a little bit nervous at performing the abortion because they wouldn't be sure they wouldn't be prosecuted anyway. Even for the woman's health, to go back to the example of the girl with the malignancy, the statutes will have extremely narrow exceptions for the life of the woman, but they are unclear about exactly how sure we have to be she's going to die. Is it a 50%, 70%, 80% chance she's going to die, or is that still just a risk to her health? You know, at what point do we say that it's so absolutely certain she's going to die that we finally let her have the abortion instead of dying to give birth to a child that probably won't survive either? And most states have no exception that would encompass the range of women's health issues that are necessary. We've got reports, for example, of a woman who had diabetes and discovered along the way that the fetus she was carrying also had some devastating defects. But because of the delays and restrictions, she wound up not being able to have the abortion, had to go through an induced labor and delivery. And because of her own health conditions, it left her much weaker and with some severe infection problems that were completely unavoidable. So one of the things that's really important to remember is that especially after 20 weeks, no situation is the same as the next. They're all very individual, and it's why passing a kind of comprehensive and categorical law is often very bad policy because it does not account for the individual variations in the situations we're facing.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Alta Charo, a professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison, talking about the ethical and political and legal implications of a proposed 20-week ban on abortions in Wisconsin. Governor Walker said this week he would sign legislation that would ban abortions in Wisconsin after the 20th week of pregnancy. And we are welcoming your questions, your reactions. We're welcoming maybe your experiences. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking about the policy and the politics of the news this week that Governor Walker is expecting a bill from the state legislature that would ban abortions in Wisconsin after 20 weeks of pregnancy. And he said that he would sign that bill when it reaches his desk. So what do you make of that? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@WPR.org. Our guest is Alta Charo, a professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison. So, Professor Charo, if this legislation were passed but included exceptions for rape and incest and an exception for cases that endanger the life or health of the mother, then would all be well with a ban like this?
No, because it still is restricting abortion, making it impossible and illegal before the fetus is viable. I mean, this is exactly the kind of thing that's been presented repeatedly to the federal courts and to the state courts, and they have consistently found that the 20-week abortion bans are unconstitutional. Last year, for example, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down that Arizona law that I mentioned earlier, finding that a woman, quote, has a constitutional right to choose to terminate pregnancy before the fetus is viable. It's black-letter law. So unless that changes, the 20-week bans are really symbolic. They're about positioning, and as you put it before, they're about politics. I mean, Congress has particularly strong control over the District of Columbia because D.C. is not its own state. So they were able to pass, or able to try to pass something like this for D.C. And when it was challenged, the promoter of the bill, Representative Franks, he actually acknowledged that it was just symbolic in politics. He, again, to use a quote, he said, quote, "It will cost some people the election, but it will cost more Democrats the election than it will cost Republicans," unquote. So these laws are about everything except that they're about everything except what they purport to be about.
Andre Jacques, who is a state legislator who is saying that there is some drafting of legislation that would ban abortions in Wisconsin at a point in time. He apparently told the State Journal that it is not yet known when the bill will be introduced, and it does not, as of yet, establish a specific cutoff point of 20 weeks gestation. So I'm wondering if the state legislature says, okay, 25 weeks, does that then, is the fetus then viable?
Well, then we get into a very interesting kind of gray area about how we define viability, and that really has changed over time. So, you know, birth outcomes that 20 years ago would have resulted in a quick death now might result in a longer life, but with extraordinary, extraordinary disabilities. You can have children who were born with only half a brain, children who will never be able to be conscious, children who will suffer from constant, unremitting seizures. So there's always been a very interesting conversation about what we really mean by viability. Is it viability to survive even if it's only for a few seconds in whatever condition? Or is it viability to survive for some longer period of time, unspecified, with some minimal quality of life, again, unspecified? So if a bill were written in the way that you're suggesting, I think it would simply move on to the next level of conversation, which is, what do we actually know? How much does it vary from pregnancy to pregnancy? And who gets to decide on these definitions? Is it politicians in the legislature? Is it the medical professional societies? Is it the individual doctor? These are questions that have not been resolved.
Let's go back to the phones. Janet in Wauwatosa. Hello, Janet.
Hi. Yeah, I just wanted to make a brief comment that if a woman wants to have an abortion, she will have one legally or illegally, and that's unfortunate. That's all. Thank you.
Well, what do you say to that, Professor?
Well, experience would confirm that during the years between the mid-19th century and mid-20th century when abortion was largely illegal, because remember, it was not illegal during colonial times when the country was founded. During that 100-year, 100-some-odd-year period, we certainly had lots of evidence that women were having abortions. They were just doing it without any formal medical assistance. There were various kinds of midwives and other alternative care providers. Women did it for themselves. They did it to themselves. The outcomes were often tragic because without proper facilities and training, it's very easy to get yourself incredibly sick or even to kill yourself. And we know in countries where it's still illegal that this is also going on. When you look at South America, you see this pattern all the time. The 20-week ban, I don't have to say, is a little different because it's really not feasible to be self-aborting at 20 weeks except by trying to induce some kind of catastrophic miscarriage. So what we used to see more often was much earlier in pregnancy, women trying everything from potions to objects that they would stick inside themselves in a desperate attempt to disrupt the pregnancy.
Sarah on Facebook says, my doctor recommended that we wait until 20 weeks for the first ultrasound so that they can take all of the needed measurements. Well, what if that's when we learn our baby's brain is growing outside of its head or something else awful? It would then be after 20 weeks and too late, under this legislation, presumably, to terminate a pregnancy. That wouldn't result with a healthy living child. I don't know, Professor Charo, if you know if that's the case. Is that typical that you wait until 20 weeks before you get an ultrasound to find this stuff out?
I'm not a physician, and there aren't quite enough facts in there to know why there was an ultrasound that was needed that late. Because many ultrasounds are done much earlier. But yes, of course, there's some conditions that are going to be continually evolving, and I can easily see a situation where physicians need more time. But, you know, the 20-week ban, even if it were legal, which for the moment it's not, right? It'll mm-hmm. just be non-functional until the Roe versus Wade decision is overturned. But even if we have the 20-week ban, anybody who's discovering at the 20th week that they really do think an abortion is the only good course of action, it's going to have a hard time getting it because abortion doctors have been so terrorized and literally have been murdered for doing the work that they do, that we have only one or two places in the United States where you can even get an abortion at these late stages. It's really hard to find somebody who can do it, and to get there, if you've got a job, you've got other kids to care for, not so easy to travel halfway across the country to get to one of the few people that will help you out. So we're already in a tragic situation for people like the person who just wrote in.
Yeah. Well, Professor Charles, you said that when Roe versus Wade is overturned, did you mean if?
I did mean if.
Okay. And again, just to repeat that, all of these 20-week bans on abortion are being found unconstitutional, but you believe that this will serve as a basis for a Supreme Court case that would reexamine the constitutionality of Roe versus Wade?
I think that's the goal. Now, the Supreme Court does not take very many cases. It is very careful about which ones it will actually hear. So we don't have some of the more classic triggers. For example, we're not getting conflicting decisions by different federal appellate courts in different parts of the country. That's the kind of situation where the Supreme Court might have an incentive to step in and say, we need to clarify this for everybody. But we don't have that situation. And this is such a charged issue that unless I believe the court were confident that it knows how it's going to wind up reacting to these things, there's little incentive to take the case. But I do believe the goal is to find a moment when the Supreme Court would be willing to hear a challenge in which one of these laws was challenged, was found to be unconstitutional, and an appeal was taken, and now it's time for the Supreme Court to face up to whether or not they're going to retreat from the most fundamental holding of Roe versus Wade, which is that for those of us who have already been born, our civil rights are guaranteed, and for fetuses that are not yet viable, those civil rights are not automatic, they're not guaranteed, and any rights that the state confers upon them, any interest the state has in them, is never going to be superior to the civil rights of those of us who are already here.
Let's go to Josie in Woodville. Hi, Josie.
Good morning. I'd like to say that abortions kill baby, and so abortions are never a right choice, and there is no civil right to kill. Abortions are wrong regardless of what the Supreme Court said in Roe v. Wade. Even though they called it unconstitutional, it is a bad law. It's a bad decision. And men are also responsible for protecting that unborn baby. It's not just the woman who's responsible to protect it. And there's a reason for why there's guilt there, because you have murdered a human being. Society must protect the most vulnerable, and women should not be allowed to legally murder.
Thank you very much, Josie. What's your response to that point of view, Professor Charles?
Well, I think it's a point of view that's shared by a lot of Americans. I think it's a point of view that is grounded in a variety of things, and I wouldn't presume to know what is motivating or is informing the caller's views. But it is not a view that is universally shared, nor is it, in my opinion, one that is impossible to disagree with on logical grounds. We have a whole variety of dilemmas here. People who support criminalization of abortion but nonetheless support some kind of exception for rape and incest are saying basically that there are some situations where it's so distressing for a woman or so unfair for a woman that she shouldn't have to go through with this birth. That's actually conceding that there's a balancing test to be done here. And now let's fight now about what are the interests that women have that should be considered important enough that she shouldn't have to go to term. For those who say that there's no exception for rape or incest, they tend to be a distinct minority. In fact, this was attempted in, I think it was Idaho, and it lost as a ballot measure because it seems so incredibly callous to the reality of women's lives. There are people who argue that it is an absolute wrong that the government must criminalize because the developing embryo and fetus are human and they have the potential for survival. But there's lots of things that are human. Every cell in your body is human. And as far as the potential for survival, most pregnancies actually end in miscarriage. I mean, or not most, but a tremendous number of them. So how much potential does it have to have? I'm not saying that she is wrong so much as these are the things that people want to debate. And for people who don't have a religious view that includes the notion of a soul entering a body at any point, that doesn't become a, you know, kind of an end of the argument moment. So one of the constant challenges in America and in democracy is figuring out when something is so absolute that it is appropriate for the government to essentially adopt one position and enforce it on all of us, and when it is so disputed that we have to have some degree of diversity of views and diversity of action permitted. It's exactly where the abortion debate has been joined.
Diana in Eau Claire is with us now. Hi, Diana.
Hello. As a caller said about protecting individuals who are deemed vulnerable, that really ends for Governor Walker after those children are born. Your guest mentioned people with who will grow to have very severe disabilities. Governor Walker's budget right now is slashing and ending and drastically altering the systems that support these individuals. This will lead to less community-based care, less self-directed care, less individualized care, and much more reliance on institutional-type, nursing home-type settings for these individuals as they age.
Thank you very much, Diana. We'll, by the way, be talking probably more about that specific cut coming up on another show. But what about Professor Charo, the argument that pro-life should mean more than not having an abortion?
Well, I think it's one of the most frustrating parts of the debate around abortion that we do not focus on the things that actually would do more to save more children. So first, for people who view abortion as an unadulterated wrong, or even, as your caller said, murder, the best way to stop abortion, the single best way to stop abortions, is to make contraception more easily available. That's it. More contraception equals fewer abortions, and you'll reduce the number of abortions profoundly more effectively than if you ban any number of abortions after 20 weeks or 22 weeks or whatever. Then, if you really are worried more about children, your caller is absolutely right. We are doing a terrible job of helping families care for children who have profound needs, and even helping families care for children who don't have such profound needs in terms of family leave policies and minimum wage policies, all the things that make it possible to care for your family in a way that helps your children thrive. So we're doing a terrible job either at stopping abortion, because we don't make contraception easy at all, or at helping children, because we're not doing a great job helping families support their children, healthy or in special need. That is really frustrating and makes me so angry. I can hardly talk about abortion any longer.
We'll only make you talk about it for one more minute, as that's the end of our show. Do you see this 20-week ban on abortions happening in Wisconsin?
I think there's a very good chance it'll pass, if only because it might be advantageous for the legislature to pass it. Those members get a chance to show their position, and it's advantageous in some ways for the governor to have a chance to sign it, because it gives him a clear platform if he continues with what looks like a very strong presidential bid. But I don't think it's going to become effective law, not now, not for a long time, and probably not ever.
Thank you very much for being with us.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Alta Charo, professor of law and bioethics at UW-Madison. Thanks very much to Christy Taylor for producing and directing this program. Thanks to Kayla Blado for on-air production. Thank you for listening. I hope you stay tuned. Much more to come. Coming up this afternoon at 12:30, we will be streaming online at WPR.org, the annual State of the Tribes address. That's coming up at 12:30 on WPR.org. Join us tomorrow at this time for the Week in Review, two guests from different perspectives talking about the top stories in politics this week. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.